Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
So, Jim, I've been working on a new song, but I just can't seem to get the opening riff right. You got any advice?
Well, yeah. You know, some of the best riffs, Patrick, are also the simplest. If you're playing more than two notes, you're just showing off. Okay, Patrick, so today we're going to feature another interview that we have recently done on the Zoom. Yeah. This was a pretty fun one.
Really was.
Yeah.
A lot of fun. Super nice guys.
Yeah, super nice guys. So, the show you're listening to is called Rockin' the Suburbs. We are in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. in Northern Virginia. We occasionally do some interviews on the show lately over Zoom because it's kind of impossible to get together with artists these days, and and it's been fun checking in with the different people from their homes and so on. And my name is Jim Lenihan,
and my name is Patrick Foster.
And today's interview subjects are the Popoff brothers, AJ and Jeremy, and you may know them from a band called Lit.
L-I-T, a little band that had a song you probably know as well.
So they've had a few hit songs.
Yep,
and probably the most well-known would be a song called My Own Worst Enemy, and we're going to talk at some length about that song. It's about 20, what did we decide, 21 years ago that song came out. The band had been planning to do a big tour in celebration of that album called A Place in the Sun this summer, but things, you know, got waylaid there, so I think they're looking at doing something like that for next year. There is a special, you know, anniversary edition of that album that is out, you can find. And then the other thing we're going to talk about probably more in tomorrow's episode, we divided this interview into two parts, but probably more in tomorrow's episode, we're going to talk a little bit more about their more current stuff, including they're even recording now separately as the Popoff brothers because they're taking kind of a different sound with the band. And so they decided to kind of like keep the Lit sound over here in this bucket and then have their new sound be called the Popoff Brothers, right?
Totally. And it's a really interesting conversation about, you know, a band in transition, and they're currently in two different locations. So we're going to hear a little bit about that as well.
Yeah. Really cool. So if you're familiar with the song My Own Worst Enemy, I'm sure you probably are. It's been a big, like, sort of rock radio staple for the last couple of decades. And to me, it's one of the, like, best kind of, like, smart, funny songs you'll hear, right?
Great way to describe it.
I love it. And so when we got the opportunity to get them on, I was like, yeah, of course, I want to talk about that song all day long if we can.
Definitely.
So let's do it. So, all right. So here we go. Let's roll tape here. This is our interview with AJ and Jeremy Popoff. Patrick, this is exciting. We have the Popoff brothers on our show here. AJ from Orange County, in the process of moving to Nashville, and Jeremy in Nashville. Hello, guys.
Yes, sir. How are you guys doing?
Good. Thank you guys so much for doing this. We really appreciate it.
Yep. It's our pleasure. So, thanks for having us, man.
Thanks for having us, man.
You know, it's unfortunate we can't interview people in person like we used to do, Patrick, but one of the cool things with the recording over the Zoom videos, you could see like the gold records in their house and stuff like that, right?
That's kind of cool, man.
Yeah.
And your vinyl collection, man, that was just saying how impressive that is, man.
Thank you, man.
Do you have any idea how many you got there?
probably, I haven't counted in a while. There's a whole, yeah, there's another wall that goes that way too. So I don't know, like 3,000 or 4,000. I actually narrowed it down not long ago. And I've been, I don't know if you guys know Discogs. It's kind of a cool like online vinyl marketplace. So I've been kind of selling a few and buying some that I, in some cases, sold back or bought a long time ago, and some stuff I've always wanted. So it, yeah, I've always been one of those guys who thinks records cost $5. I try to roll that way. So.
That's right.
I have my whole vinyl collection from growing up, my teenage years. So I've got right behind you here is a whole, I have all my records from when I was 12, 13, 14.
Dude.
Okay, first so let's go through that one by one. What do you have?
Yeah.
The first record I ever bought with my own money was AC/DC Back in Black.
Oh, that's pretty good. And that's way better than mine. Yeah. Mine was Billy Joel, The Stranger, as listeners to this podcast have heard me admit.
I can see that cover right now. Yeah, I remember that one. Yeah,
well, I have that one too, but AJ and I, our dad was a radio DJ when we were little kids. So.
Oh.
I have The Stranger in my collection, but it's one that he brought home for free from Kiss FM back in the day. So
even better.
Got a little hole punched in the corner.
That's all right. Those are the best ones, the free ones.
Okay, so here's a question I want to ask about that, since you were talking about your father and the DJ thing. So
yeah.
My father was a bill collector. So he had minimal impact on my music interests, right? But for you guys, that must have been huge, right? Just music, what, all the time at your house?
Well, the cool thing is our dad worked for a long time, worked in Top 40 radio. And at the time, Top 40, the format was basically the top 40 songs across the board, all genres. So we were getting just the best songs of all genres. So for us, it kind of kept us from falling into, we like disco or rock or rap, which came a little later on. But, it was kind of cool that the lines were all blurred across the board, which kind of kept our minds open.
That is cool.
So how are you holding up, with the pandemic and what's going on and, the not being able to go out on tour like you planned and all of that?
We're doing about as well as, everybody is. I mean, it's this every day there's a new thing. Every day it's like new information, misinformation, new theories, new rules. And so, you wake up one day going, what are we going to, what's going to happen today? And so I feel like there's definitely some good things, though. I mean, my son is here from college, like representing the Utes on my hat. And he was here for the first 5 weeks of the quarantine, and that was just awesome. As much as it sucked being on lockdown like that and having everything shut down, it was, I can't remember the last time I spent 5 weeks with my kid.
Yeah.
What a time we're in.
It is like, it's an emotional roller coaster, like you said, every day you just wonder what's going to happen? What's going to change? Is it going to change for the better? And it's usually, a setback of some sort, we're hearing about on a daily basis. And it's confusing. It's discombobulating. We're trying to try and be creative. It sucks to have all these curveballs thrown at you where you can't really focus, it feels like. So as songwriters, it's made it a lot more challenging, I think, to get in a zone, and really, or even just feel inspired, where we've never really been inspired by politics, and that's all we're surrounded by right now. And, it kind of sucks.
Yeah.
You were supposed to be spending this summer, touring like an anniversary type show for A Place in the Sun, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. A Place in the Sun turns 21 and, we should have probably did it last year.
I don't know. 21's a big one, though.
I mean, I guess next year will be 2021. We could still probably use some of the merch.
There you go.
it was kind of when all this first happened, around March, we thought, we'll be fine by July. I mean, it's only going to be a couple weeks. And, now they're talking. I mean, they're talking all kinds of craziness, but I mean, we'll see, man. We're obviously chomping at the bit to get back out and get back to some level of normalcy, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, being songwriters, have either of you had the thought, well, all right, you know, I'm just going to turn inward right now and, you know, record my own songs or like write a whole bunch of songs, you know, while I'm locked down to try to get, you know, this feeling and take advantage of, well, not necessarily take advantage, but deal with your circumstances. I mean, have you guys had that thought cross your mind at any point?
It's crossed our mind, and we definitely have been doing our best to be creative, and it's there are some people, some of my really close friends are very great at it, and they've been writing every day, and they've been just really enjoy. I got one buddy who's he likes this better. He likes the Zoom he likes the Zoom write better. For me, you know, sitting in a room with a couple guys, you know, if AJ and I are sitting in a room and you know, somebody says something, or someone's kid walks by and says something, or something happens, you know, those are the moments where you channel something that falls out of the sky and you go, oh, let's write that. When you're on a Zoom write, it's very focused. It's very much this. And so it can definitely be done, and it's definitely an art form. So is songwriting. So I think it's just going to take a little more time for it to feel. I just feel like you've got to have human vibes in the room if you're going to capture lightning, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm praying that we don't hear a bunch of songs next year about viruses. And
I know, man. Totally.
Because
you know, like you said, like, well, I think too, like what Jared's saying is it's maybe it's a something we could adapt to and get better at. I mean, when we first started out, we were much more, you know, a garage band or, you know, right, warehouse band. And we would all plug in and churn up really loud. And that's how we wrote songs, was full volume and full band. And then we'd go back home and, you know, Jeremy and I would hone in on like lyrics and, you know, craft it a little bit tighter. But you know, it was weird to get used to, like for example, the Nashville style of writing, where we would get in a room with guys that weren't even necessarily musicians, but great songwriters, and sit around with acoustic guitars versus a room that's loud and you've got that energy from that.
Right.
So, you know, there are, like Jeremy said, I guess there's some advantages to that. Some people geek out and like it better. We're still yet to find that.
Okay, so here, I want to get to this right now. So one of the things we do on our podcast every so often is we'll talk about a what we call perfect pop song, a song that we just think is perfect. And Patrick and I, or I will weigh in, you know, have a new version or a new edition where we'll talk about a different song, or sometimes we'll have guests talk about a song they think is perfect, so on. Well, for me, I always have this sort of like running list of perfect pop songs. And I'm not lying when I say this. One of the songs on my list is My Own Worst Enemy.
Right.
To me, it's just like a perfect song. So I want to start with talking about that, especially since you guys are celebrating that album this year anyway with a special edition, a special re-release. Well, I guess the first question is just this. Like, how did that song come together? What went into making that song?
It was back in the day, like when I was just saying about how we would get, you know, we'd stop at the liquor store and pick up a 12 pack of Natural Light and head over to our warehouse that we had for a very long time. And, you know, we would get there and much like a writing session now, we'd crack open a cold beer and just sit around and talk about, you know, what was going on and, in our lives and whatnot and drink some beers. And then we'd plug in and start jamming. And that was one of those nights, you know, where we, it came together, you know, started out with a riff, and it definitely wasn't something that felt ultra magical or anything. We didn't know that, you know, that this song was going to stick around for, you know, 20 years and be played on the radio or any of that stuff. It was just, we were just doing what we do. And, it's a song about, really, it's about kind of what we were living as well. You know, it was lyrically, it didn't really take form until, you know, it's kind of started as a riff and melody and a groove. And, you know, I had a little notepad in my car because I drove a 63 Cadillac with a broken fuel gauge. and it, and I had to write down my mileage so I knew when I was going to be close to running out of gas. I knew I got about 8 miles to the gallon, and kind of just did the math. And in that little notepad, I still have it. I have a piece of paper in my the pad in my one of my memorabilia boxes. But I wrote the line. It's no surprise to me. I am my own worst enemy. Every now and then, I kick the living shit out of me. And it just so you know, it was just one of those things. Like, well, maybe this will work in with this feel, you know, in this song. And I don't know, Jer, why don't you take it from there?
I mean, it was kind of interesting because the riff came, and then the groove came, and then that scrap of paper came out, and then we just wrote all the words right then and there. It really was kind of one of those songs that came about within a relatively short, maybe 45 minutes or something. Hmm. And the interesting thing about that song, I mean, first of all, thank you for saying that it's a perfect pop song. The funny thing is, it's actually the least perfect pop song probably on the planet, because it literally breaks every rule in songwriting. If there are rules, but I mean, if you look at it on paper, there's nothing in it rhymes. There's no pre-chorus. There's no bridge. There's really not a guitar solo. It's just kind of a riff that just sort of elevates till it gets back to the chorus, but it's literally verse chorus riff. And then in the verses, nothing rhymes, nothing in the chorus rhymes. So the challenging thing for us today is to try every once in a while to put ourselves in a headspace where we don't pay attention to stuff like that, because that song changed our lives and it's still massive after 20 years. And the fact that all those things are true, it just really makes you scratch your head and go, well, what is a perfect pop song?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cause it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And I don't know, maybe that's why.
Maybe it is.
Well,
yeah.
It's funny though, you mentioned it not rhyming, but like, man, everybody knows the lyrics of the song. I mean, I read somewhere that it's one of the most karaoke'd songs, right? I mean, it's like, there's just something about the picture. I guess it's the picture that you paint that everybody sort of like lived that at some point in their life, right? So it's just super memorable to people when they hear it.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, it still blows our minds, you know, to this day. It's, you know, when you get in the car, go to the store, and it still comes on the radio and it gives you that. It's like, it's at that surprise feeling somehow every time. It's still like, oh, wait, oh. And sometimes I turn it up and sometimes I immediately turn the station because it still sometimes gives me an insecurity. I don't know how to explain it, but it's, it's just a weird phenomenon. That's just that we feel very, very lucky to have somehow struck, you know, it's like getting hit by lightning in a way.
So whose experience was that day, that night, that morning after?
All of us.
It's everyone. And it really wasn't until, you know, more recently. I feel like later years of Lit, and then, you know, Jeremy and I with our more recent like Nashville sessions, where we sort of got more autobiographical, I guess. In the very beginning, it was just more, it's all of us. It's just, you know, lyrics were just, we're all living this and we're going to talk about it. And sometimes it was all, you know, it was just 100% about an experience that we, you know, we sort of came from a friend or something that we just witnessed, and we're like, all right, that's a good story. Let's tell it.
Yeah.
So Jeremy, you wrote that riff?
Yeah.
Okay. So I remember many years ago, I was with a couple of buddies, and one guy had not heard the song, and the other guy was like, oh man, just wait till you hear this opening riff. You're not going to be the same after hearing this. So, because it just explodes. I mean, it just comes right out. You know, it's just like a couple of notes or a couple of chords, right? But it just like explodes right from
the two notes. It's really, it's not even chords. It's two octave notes. And, I think I went through a phase where I was fascinated by, well, first of all, I'm a riff guy. When I was a kid learning how to play guitar,
AC/DC.
I learned Back in Black, Crazy Train, a couple of Def Leppard songs like Wasted and Let It Go. And to me, like the rock songs that made me want to play guitar, every single one of them started with a riff. And so that's the school that I went to learning how to play guitar. Yeah. And then the reason I started writing songs was because I couldn't really get past the opening riff because it wasn't good enough. So I would have to make up my own songs if I was going to ever play a song from beginning to end. And so that, you know, I think the simplicity of our songs and you know, my riffs come from a real honest place of just kind of a simple player. You know, I'm not a shredder and I'm not a trained musician. I'm a self-taught guy. Our dad, like I said, he was in radio, and I remember the first time he heard that song. We played it at the Troubadour one night in LA, and he was there, and he made a comment, something along the lines of, he was like, "Wow, you guys have a song that's going to be up there with like Money for Nothing and start Me Up," you know. And I was like, holy shit, well, I never really thought of it that way. But in a way, isn't that kind of what we're all chasing for? It's not just that memorable title or lyric or that memorable melody, which are obviously equally as important, but it's that I can name that tune in the first two notes. And yeah, it's that, you know, unless the song starts cold with a vocal, that's a memorable right riff, you know. And I was fascinated for a long time about stuff like that. Like, there are songs that just, like, you go, wow, that riff is so simple. Mm-hmm. It's not even really like an exercise in guitar shredding. It's just it's just something that's going to be stuck in my head now for the rest of the day. Yeah. You know?
it's so interesting, Jeremy and AJ. I actually did not know that your dad was a DJ. I find that so interesting because I was listening to your album from 2018, These Are the Days, and they're a very, you know, you cut across that stylistic swath, like,
yeah,
you know, there's riffs, you know, and songs and melodies and stuff that pull from everywhere. I think it's so interesting. I'm just, my mind is kind of being blown at this moment about the dad DJ thing and all your different influences. So, man,
it's right on. Thanks, man.
Am I still talking?
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm gonna get out of this town. I'm gonna find me a great big dream and chase it down. I wanna make a lot of money and a whole lot of love. And I said, baby, ain't we halfway there now? Maybe these are the days, and I am the one. Maybe you're missing your day in the sun. But all your wishing and dreaming and coming and leaving, believe me, baby, these are the days. Maybe these are the days we're gonna look back on. We burn like a fire, sing like a song. Maybe you can't see it, but carpe diem, and you'll find these are the days. Yeah, these are the days.
It makes for an interesting palette, you know. It's nice to be able to, have all those things, subconscious, you know, files of just all the different exposure to different types of music and, you know, songs that whether we realize were influencing us or not, they definitely live in there, you know, in the back of our minds and come in handy, you know, when it comes to melody and probably more than anything would be, you know, just melody and.
Well, and we've said it in interviews before. We've talked about this for years about growing up as kids in the 70s and 80s when top 40 radio was literally top 40 radio. And so, you know, when we would drive around the car with our dad or our mom, or we would go to work a lot with our dad, especially when our parents were separated, our babysitter was the production room where they made the commercials at Kiss FM in Hollywood. And, you know, it wasn't weird to hear a Lionel Richie song and then all of a sudden hear a Boston song and then all of a sudden hear, you know, the Cars or
Michael Jackson.
That was just every day. That was just cool songs, and you liked what you liked. And so, it's funny. I don't know if y'all in your album collection back there, but you know those old radio shows like American Top 40 and different ones that would come in boxes of albums.
Yeah.
You know, and the engineers would queue them up. I've got a couple here from 1978.
Oh, wow.
American Top 40 with Casey Kasem. One, my dad brought them home. He brought one home on my birthday, and he brought one home. AJ and I are a week apart, 2 years and a week apart.
Wow.
And man, when you see the song list, like the log of these things, I mean, it is really as eclectic of a time for music as probably any other time, you know?
Yeah. Those typewritten sheets, right? Where they would have it all typed out and like, here's what, here's how long every song
is. Record over, you know, play this commercial.
Yeah. It even had intros. Like, here's what you can say. Like, that's amazing. Yeah. That's wild. Yeah. These are the days.
That's part one of the interview.
Yeah.
Thanks to those guys. Super fun, really engaging.
It was great. Totally interesting to learn about their dad being a DJ and bringing home all those different records for them. And that's how they sort of got into stuff. That's a very, very cool story. And totally explains a lot about the kind of the eclectic nature of their sound, even though it's based in rock and roll.
Yeah, totally. So they were just like really personable guys, as you heard. They're really fun to hang out with. Would love to sort of meet them in person sometime. They were really, really
be
cool
so
guys.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. So part two will be tomorrow. We're going to talk a little bit more about some of their, you know, more recent stuff they've been doing and sort of a change in the sound a bit for them. And plus we're also going to, you know, talk with them a little bit about kind of what every band has to do today is be like big, you know, marketers and really, you know, sell different kinds of merchandise and things like that. So sort of the realities of the music business these days.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
And we're also going to look back on a famous festival they were part of. That was Woodstock 99.
Yeah.
So you're not going to want to miss that. Of course, you're listening frequently.
Every day.
That's right. And if you have any comments, want to interact with the show, want to talk about Lit, what have you, you can call 612-440-1984. Or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram at Suburbs Pod, or you can email us rock@suburbspod.com. Thanks again to Jeremy and AJ, and you'll hear more from them again tomorrow. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And we'll talk to you guys tomorrow.
And I'll tell you this, it's way better than Start Me Up and Money for Nothing. Let's just go ahead and say that.